Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we have a double feature. We're going to start with 1995's Outbreak, followed by the 2011 movie Contagion. But first, Outbreak.
Outbreak. Who knew?
So, I think I was the one that put these on the calendar.
Yes, you did.
Okay, then I'm going to start here. One of the audiobooks that I fell in love with, it hit me in a, I don't know if it was a time or a place, or it was just I was kind of done with fiction for a bit, so I was into nonfiction pretty heavily. And so 1995's The Hot Zone by Richard Preston was an awesome book. I highly recommend that book. I also recommend the book he did afterward called Demon in the Freezer, which is about smallpox. But The Hot Zone was about Ebola and a real incident that happened in Reston, Virginia, of a sort of a mutation of Ebola that caused an outbreak not that many miles away from Washington, D.C., and it turned out to be not quite the biggest deal in the world, but it was a scary story. And the book is fascinating. Now, I'm going to point out that he has done at least one book since. One is called, like, Dangers in Level 4, which basically is just a rehash of The Hot Zone, except with more of his own personal stories, which I don't find interesting. But I highly recommend The Hot Zone because it's really well written, and it's written like a medical thriller.
So are they fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, they're all nonfiction. Yeah, no. Oh, it's absolutely 100% nonfiction. And if you haven't read Demon in the Freezer, it's amazing. It talks about how they eradicated smallpox, sort of. Except both the Russians and the United States, and maybe the French, have smallpox, both for research and just in case.
Yeah, exactly. You keep it just in case, because you have to have it to cure it.
Yeah.
And you want it in a form that can be replicated. Otherwise, if an outbreak did happen and you don't have a vaccine...
That is the least cynical response I could have thought of to that. If you remind me at the end, I have a podcast story that is tangentially related to Ebola.
Excellent. So are we ready to tackle Wolfgang Peterson's 1995 movie Outbreak?
Oh, Heidi.
All right. So I had forgotten how much I love this movie. I love all the actors. I thought it was a bunch of cheesy fun. I thought that it was a great pace. It's a great, like, summer blockbuster movie.
A little schmaltzy.
Yeah, absolutely schmaltzy. And over the top. But I think it's probably Dustin Hoffman at his most charming.
It's aged decently. I won't say it's aged incredibly well, but it's aged adequately.
Well, okay, let's start with Brother Jay. What's your first reaction after watching this again?
So, I saw this in the movie theater opening night. And I will have a story later, which we'll explain more in depth.
Well, Drew, did you see this in the theater also?
I believe I did, down in Missouri.
I'm sure I did too. And there's one scene in this movie that makes watching the theater even more awesome.
Yep, it's like a ripoff of Arachnophobia.
Yep, a little bit. We're going to refer to it as the theater scene. Mm-hmm. But anyway, okay, sorry, I interrupted. So, Brother Jay, you saw it in the theater opening night.
Opening night, yeah. It was a very quiet drive home. But I remember really liking it at the time, although also being kind of very disturbed and apprehensive, because it left you know, it leaves you with a very, especially because of the movie theater scene, having worked in a movie theater and then being in a movie theater, all of those things combined, my brain just wouldn't let go, even though it was just paranoia at that point. But I thought it was I thought at the time it was a great movie. On rewatch, I think it was a good movie. Parts of it didn't hold up so well. Parts of it held up fine. And the actors, I mean, it was well acted. And it had plenty of action. It had some cheesy parts and some over-the-top dialogue. But good God, Donald Sutherland's hair was amazing.
His eyebrows should have gotten their own credit.
His hair looked like a stuffed animal. Was super glued to his head, like a Yeti.
That's awesome. So, Drew, what was your first reaction upon rewatch?
Well, I'll say first, I remember enjoying this quite a bit in the movie theater. So I've had fond memories of this movie. I don't think I've seen it since. And I was a little surprised upon rewatch because I don't think it holds up at all. I think it's terrible. I hated just about everything in this movie. I think it doesn't play at all in a post 9/11 world. I'll say this. This is how badly the movie went over. I thought the most enjoyable performance was Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah, he was fun.
Yeah, that's not a great tagline for your movie. Cuba's pretty good.
You didn't like Frank Underwood?
I mean, as a curiosity, it was interesting. He didn't really get much to do. He got to shit on adverbs. That was funny.
He spaced it up just enough, I thought.
Mm-hmm. He was fine. He didn't really add anything.
He was James Spadering.
Yeah. So okay. So let's get into it. So why post 9/11? What's changed?
No, nobody could take off with an unsecured helicopter and get away with it for any length of time, for one.
No, I think more globally, having the villain be the U.S. military is not sort of a satisfying movie experience.
Because the military is not the villain anymore, post 9/11?
It's sort of making a cartoon out of the military in a way that, you know, when we were winding down sort of military action across the globe, it, you know, the military really seemed like a joke back in the mid-90s because there wasn't much for them to do.
Yeah, it's Grenada.
Yeah, so it's, you know, sort of like how the U.S. government sort of as an entity was the villain in a lot of the late 70s, early 80s political thrillers. And I think that doesn't play that way anymore. It would have to be like a truly transcendent thriller for that to still be okay. Something like 3 Days of the Condor. But if it's just like a mediocre movie, I don't think it works at all anymore. It really is a cartoon. You know, I think movies now have a much more complicated view of the military and what it means to be a member of the military and what it means to be a commander in the military.
Yeah, but this is a comic book movie, though. This is a summer blockbuster movie. I don't think this was any deeper than that. Was it trying for any deeper than that? It was trying to ride the wave of the Hot Zone for a thriller.
Yeah, I don't think it was trying to take itself seriously.
I didn't get camp out of this. I thought it was really preachy. That Dustin Hoffman in particular was extremely preachy.
Yeah, but that's what he does. He's good at that. Tootsie.
Yeah, I haven't seen Tootsie. But yeah, I just found the whole thing hard to swallow.
Really?
I thought it was terrible.
Have you read The Hot Zone?
Yeah, I love The Hot Zone.
Oh, okay. You just didn't like the World War Z-ing of The Hot Zone book? Actually, that's not fair.
I think that's successful. Unfair. I mean, yeah, it's closer to that, the sort of the pseudo source material than World War Z was, but I think World War Z was a better movie than this.
Oh no, I would not agree with that.
No, I do.
Well, that's a controversial thing because I love this movie. I found
We should talk about World War Z sometime because I know all three of us love the book, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
We should just talk about the book.
We should review the book and compare and contrast to the movie.
It's such a different thing than the movie is. But I think once you get over that, if you rewatch World War Z, like the last 25 minutes is really incredible.
Well, I think World War Z is fine as a movie. I mean, just my brief capsule. It's fine as a movie, as long as you divorce yourself that it has anything to do with the book.
Yeah, if it wasn't called World War Z.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it's fine. The problem is that it was trying to cash in on the name.
I hated everything about Outbreak. I was surprised. I expected to like it, and I couldn't get over it.
Wow. That's bold, because I had the opposite reaction. Well, I can't wait to talk about Contagion later then. But yeah, I thought the fact that this was a fast-paced, kind of loosey-goosey thriller, but more kind of a fun, kind of a comic book movie a little bit. You've got a clear hero in Dustin Hoffman, and he's doing his hero's journey fighting against the man. And the man in this case is Donald Sutherland and Morgan Freeman. So that's if you're going to have a combination of bad guys, that's a pretty good one. Although in the opening scene, which I was shocked how bloody some of this movie was.
Yeah.
But the opening scene of this movie, which I thought, especially in the theaters, was just awesome because it really was like brutal.
It was jarring.
Yeah. The first thing is, you know, you see these guys in the 60s version of the biohazard suits that walk into the tent, and the sick guy hears their voices. Here's Donald Sutherland's voice and says, "You're Americans." And my first thought was, he's a Canadian. Like, he doesn't even have an American accent in this movie. He's got a Donald Sutherland accent.
Well, I think there was a good sleight of hand by putting him in the suits, because you couldn't see what their age really was, so it was easy to make it appear like they were younger.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was great because, you know, you had all those, like, Vietnam-era helicopters and stuff, which you still kind of had in the 80s, but, you know...
The helicopters didn't match, though. That drove me crazy.
It didn't match one another?
Nope.
Well, in Africa.
They were not the same model and not the same year. It really bugged me.
You can't, you know, in Africa, I bet you those helicopters are still in use.
they were loaned out from Apocalypse Now.
None of this movie was actually shot in Africa or anywhere other than Southern California, probably. But still. Yeah, I thought it was a great start to it. I thought that the tension between Rene Russo and as Dustin Hoffman's ex-wife.
Robbie.
And Dustin Hoffman. I thought that was a little shoehorned in, but at least it gave, like, again, typical hero's journey. He's got problems at home and he's got problems at work, but he's a good guy and he's stubborn. That's his weakness, is he's too good.
Yeah, I didn't buy the chemistry between the two. That I didn't buy.
I'm trying to think of a movie where Rene Russo has chemistry with anybody. Like, I haven't seen Thomas Crown Affair in a long time, but...
Oh, no.
Yeah, I didn't remember that fondly.
Mm-mm.
I mean, I think she's fine, but she doesn't have much to work with in this movie.
Was she in Line of Fire?
Yes, she was. Yeah, that could have been.
Yeah.
How about Riggs in Lethal Weapon 3?
wasn't Lethal Weapon 3 the Joe Pesci one?
2 and 3 were the Joe Pesci ones.
Okay. And Chris Rock was in 4?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh my God, I am sad for you.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, but we see a Lieutenant Colonel, Casey Schuler, Kevin Spacey, who's spacing it up in a happy way. I mean, he got in. He got his little Spacey barbs. I was waiting for his impressions, but he didn't have any impressions.
Yeah, but he was really spadering, though. He was almost James Spader.
How so?
I swear. His look. Like, the shaved head and the glasses and the pointy top and his witticism. I don't know. I just got that James Spader. Probably because we watched that horrible, god-awful 2 Days in the Valley movie. Maybe it's a little top of mind, but anyway.
No, see, I thought...
Yeah, I thought you'd come around on that movie by the end of that podcast.
Yeah.
No, I didn't hate it. I'm just saying, I was like, you know, James Spader wasn't my...
Well, okay, but see, I thought, again, in comic book fashion, I thought Kevin Spacey was a great, he was a sidekick. He was a wisecracking sidekick.
Yeah.
So that's a movie trope. That's fun. And you have the new guy, Major Salt, who is he's book smart, but not savvy. He's a fish out of water. And Cuba Gooding Jr. does a great job with that military bearing, but you get the idea that he doesn't know quite what he's doing. I mean, he didn't end up in a bus full of Lucy's, but it was still a lot of fun. And then we have Rene Russo.
Bus full of Lucy's, that's the best thing.
I don't get it.
It's from Rat Race.
Have you not seen
Rat Race? Have you seen Rat Race?
I have not seen Rat
Race. Oh my god. We're going to have to watch. We should live blog or live
Should I bring it with me?
I've got it. I'll bring it. Okay. I've got it. I got it within, I think, within arm's reach. And that's one of my favorite movies to loan out. That's one of the few comedy movies I totally recommend completely without
any shame or abandon.
Concern, yeah. It's got something for everybody. Okay, how about this? So, Drew, I'm going to sell you on this movie with three words, okay?
Okay, I'm ready. I'm open to it.
Patrick Dempsey's hair.
Yeah.
Yes.
I loved Patrick Dempsey's hair. I had Patrick Dempsey's hair.
The last half hour of this movie was so terrible. It made me forget about how awesome Patrick Dempsey's whole entire performance was.
Do you know what Patrick Dempsey's hair reminded me of?
What?
Your car wash fringe jacket.
Yeah, all that. Yep, that was great.
Yeah, sorry. Cuba just got demoted. It was Patrick Dempsey all the way.
Yeah, no, yeah. Patrick Dempsey's great.
Yeah.
And what about Marcel?
Was that the same monkey from Friends?
It was.
Fucking monkey.
Sure looked the same, but, you know, I didn't want to be racist.
What is... Are we... What, are you putting E.T. on the calendar?
That's what... Jesse drew that.
Okay.
Because I kept saying, through the movie, I kept saying, fucking monkey... Because every time the monkey would show up, I would say that. I would scream it out. It was kind of a heckle. And so that's what he drew me. And after he drew it, he was like, yeah, it doesn't really look like a monkey. I was like, no, it looks like E.T.
Yeah, totally. So
I'm glad you had the same reaction I did.
What did Jesse think of this movie?
We didn't talk a lot about it. He's seen it before. I think he liked it.
I am shocked that you guys are not fully on board with Outbreak.
I liked it. I watched it.
I'm going to cross out all the Chuck Norris movies on the calendar now, because you're not going to like those either.
I'm just saying, I won't like the Chuck Norris movies.
All of the Charles Bronson movies are getting crossed out.
Yep, I won't like those for sure.
Anything with anybody named Dolph in it is getting crossed out.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah.
No. I think those movies are supposed to be something else. This movie, I think, was trying something, and... it was not working for me.
Well, but it worked at the time. You think it just, for you, for you personally, it just didn't age well.
Yeah. And I may not have been in the right mood to watch this movie, but anytime Dustin Hoffman said anything in my mind, I was like, fuck you.
So how did you feel about the kid in peril aspect of the movie?
You know, it's tough for me since I have kids now, but I was still actively rooting for her to get bitten. Shout out to Real Housewives of Orange County.
Oh, is that what she ended up in as an adult?
She's the daughter of one of the original Housewives.
Ah.
Who is this we're talking about?
The monkey girl.
Yeah. The little girl.
What's her name? With
Kara Keogh.
And who's her mother?
Jackie Keogh.
And who's she married to?
I think she was single. I think she was divorced for most of the show.
Charlie Murphy.
Never mind. Okay. So maybe we don't have anything to talk about Outbreak. Maybe we need to go straight on to stories.
I took notes. I took plenty of notes.
I mean, the only real note I have, other than the fact that I thought they got the sense, they got the nut, they got the kernel of the hot zone, right? They didn't try to go too big. This is not an end of the world movie. This is an end of the town movie.
But if they didn't destroy the town, it was an end of the world movie.
Yeah, there's that. And okay, so if we're gonna call Dustin Hoffman a bad soldier, we can, because he's violating all these direct orders. That you under I think the military code of conduct, you're also not only allowed to, but you're
bound.
Obliged to disobey orders that are immoral or. Yeah. So, yes. I mean, there's that. So I think he can get away with, he's never going to be a general.
That is why it doesn't make any sense that they would even call an airstrike on an American town. Who would actually carry out that order?
Well,
who would carry out that order today or back then?
I mean, you know, now it would be dropped by a drone. So yeah. That helps things. That's what a lot of these questions are about is like, you know, because if you screw it up, you know, if one person gets out of a quarantined area, you are fucked.
Are you kidding? For $1.50, Halliburton would do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, there are people that would do that. And yeah. The idea of being trained is you're trained to, you know, that's what they do. And I could also see that the bomber should have had an escort of fighter jets so that it could have taken care of any helicopter. But
yeah,
that's fine. Again, it's... I mean, this is about a movie you wanted to root for at the end. You wanted the audience to clap.
I wasn't rooting for them.
You wanted them to bomb the town?
No, I didn't want to bomb the town, but like, I was okay with Rene Russo dying. I think that probably would have been a better movie. Not because I didn't like her, just for as apocalyptic as the scenario was, I thought this movie just didn't really have the stakes. I never felt the weight of the stakes of this movie. And I think it's because they were spending too much time being preachy. Wait, now correct me if I'm wrong. Was there not a scene where Dustin Hoffman said, sir, fuck you, sir?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Come on. No. No.
You don't think that would happen?
It's like it gave me the same feeling of The Long Kiss Goodnight. When Gina Davis said, suck my dick. I was like, it's like you crafted the entire movie just to get to this one line that you think is going to be your mic drop. And it went over so flat for me that I just wanted to burn the whole thing down.
So you were like, you're upset about hacky writing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was really lazy. Like when they were trying to like really, really cement home just what an evil bastard Donald Sutherland was. They had him have the conversation where he's like, "You hope to make general one day? Well, you won't."
Oh yeah,
no reason. No, there was no reason for him to shit on that guy.
No, Donald Sutherland was a Bond villain.
No, no, he wasn't.
Jeez.
Wow. So, do you think the plot was okay? It was just the dialogue.
Oh no, you have a problem with the plot.
Do you think if it had better dialogue, though, you would have forgiven the plot some?
Maybe. I mean, I guess we'll see when we talk about Contagion.
Well, can we rewrite it right now?
Recast it, maybe.
No, not even recast it. But like, okay, so do you agree that the opening scene was a good stage setter?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, gives you that nice, deep, dark feeling.
Mm-hmm. That's it's an entirely different movie.
Yeah, yeah, a much darker movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you think Patrick Dempsey's hair actually is part of the problem? Should this have been a darker movie?
No, I'm not going to complain about the only redeeming part of this movie.
No, but I mean, seriously, I mean, should it have been a lot darker?
I think so. I think...
His hair was pretty dark.
Dustin Hoffman's main motivation in this movie was just to prove everybody that he's right.
He's that guy.
Yeah. Fuck that guy.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to root for that guy in real life, do you?
No.
Except that the world is made up of that guy. I mean, surgeons are that guy.
Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, I mean, Sully Sullenberger is that guy.
So, early in the movie, if he took on like more of a mentor role from the outset with Salt and like really made a connection with him as the new guy, taking him under his wing, and then Salt has that freak out his first time in the field and takes off his hood and contracts a horrible disease and dies, I think that gives some weight to future decisions that Dustin Hoffman makes. But instead he freaks out, he takes off the hood, and then some random guy comes in and goes, "It's not airborne." I'm like, "Oh, all right."
Well, okay, so maybe if we rewrote the Dustin Hoffman character to be the more mentoring boss and Kevin Spacey to be the guy who just doesn't like the new guy?
Yeah.
That about right?
Sure.
Keeps all the tropes in line, but that way we have more sympathy for Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. I was never once rooting for Dustin Hoffman in this movie.
Yeah, he was kind of butting head. And actually, early on you established that he's not right most of the time. I mean, he's kind of a crank.
But he never, yeah, he acknowledged that he wasn't right, but he never believed he was wrong.
Oh, of course, yeah. He's that guy.
Yeah, so, I mean, he didn't have any internal conflict.
So we needed to cast somebody who's not as charming on the screen as Dustin Hoffman. Kevin Spacey should have been that character.
It would have been interesting for them to flip roles and have him be the charmless lead and have Dustin Hoffman be the hacky sidekick.
I would have believed the chemistry between Kevin Spacey and Rene Russo better.
Okay, how about Dustin Hoffman instead of, we'll leave Kevin Spacey where he is, but instead of Dustin Hoffman, we'll put in...
John Malkovich.
No.
Christopher Walken.
No, I was thinking more of a... now I can't think of his name. Dennis Leary.
Oh, God.
You know what made me mistrust Dustin Hoffman from the very beginning? He works a job where he has to travel anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. Right? So, and it takes such a toll on him that his marriage to a colleague who has similar interests and values, his marriage to her, falls apart because he makes stupid decisions like he's going to get two giant dogs and need a lot of attention that he has to find something to do with anytime he has to travel at a moment's notice. That's a bad life decision. That's dumb. It makes me not trust him.
Jeez.
This doesn't make any sense. It makes for like a cute scene in a movie where he's washing the dogs. That's it.
We'll recast the dogs as children. How about that?
Yeah, I was going to say it was tension for them to fight over.
Yeah, but, you know, we have a biological imperative to reproduce. Nothing says we have to buy German Shepherds, or not German Shepherds, St. Bernards. St. Bernards.
Rescues. They are rescues.
From an outbreak?
They were Zairean St. Bernards, just so you know.
All right, I could get on board with that.
Okay. They did the whole quarantine thing. You know, they lived in Hawaii for that time, so. It's all in the book. So this is awesome. That's great. So, yeah, so if we can't get on board from the very beginning, selling you on this movie is going to be very difficult. I just think it's like a typical, like maybe a throwback to the late 80s style of movie, even though it's in 1995. In a happy way, in a way that it's like True Lies, or although it's not really a comedy, actually it's not a comedy at all, but it kind of feels, it's a feel good kind of movie at the end. It's a Hallmark movie compared to the next movie we're going to talk about, more or less.
Yeah, that's fair ish.
So Jason, you want to tell your outbreak story?
Well, first I want to point out some things about the movie we'll move off of it. So there were a couple of things that stood out to me.
Drew knocked me completely off of my whole game.
I got
tracks.
That.
It derailed.
I thought it was interesting in the beginning of the movie where they have that master exposition of the biosafety levels.
Credit scenes, the opening credit scenes was brilliant.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Yep, that was really good.
That was really good.
But then I had a problem where would they really cover a hole in an isolation suit with duct tape?
I think so. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
On a bio level 4?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. They would get a new suit. They would not use duct tape.
Sure they would. I think so. You let layers and layers and layers and layers.
They already use duct tape. Yeah, that's how they seal their cuffs.
Yeah, it's in the book. But okay, that's fine. I mean,
I doubt it.
If it took you out of it, but no, I think that's for real.
The autopsy scene that Rene Russo does in Robbie does in the hospital, where you see the reflection of the body in her face mask, is great cinematography. It's some great craft because you just see just enough that is just disgusting.
Yeah, this also, is an R-rated movie, right?
Yeah,
was it PG-13? Yeah, because yeah. No, this is there's violence.
There's a lot of swearing.
Yeah, a lot of swearing.
Yeah, it was R. It also made a shit ton of money, by the way. But
shows you how bad movies were in 1995.
Jeez.
Also, the cinematography when they went through the air duct to follow the pathogen through the air, that was some great cinematography we really hadn't seen at that point yet.
Yeah, that was cutting edge, absolutely.
That was kind of some good camera work.
That whole movie theater scene is amazing.
Yeah, the movie theater scene is cringeworthy. It makes me just even more germophobic.
Oh, it's great.
But then I also had that, I don't think helicopters can just be stolen. I don't think they can just, helicopter take off. Especially in a military setting where there's martial law. I don't think people would just be letting people hop on helicopters to steal them all the time. Especially after the first time. So, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No, there's problems there. But I think that's in any kind of action thriller movie, you have to suspend a little disbelief.
You know, and it had that sappy Hollywood ending, and then, you know, just my quote, fucking monkey. Fucking monkey. Every time I saw it on screen, that's what I screamed. It was like my trope. I think Jesse got tired of it after a while.
Did I ever tell you guys my Papper story?
Is that, you mean the guy that plays harmonica for the Blues Traveler?
No.
John Popper?
That's Popper. Wow. No.
Nitrate? No, sorry.
I did a cleanup job where we were looking for Agent Orange, so I had to suit up in a passive air purifying respirator suit.
Is that with the big filter on the back?
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's got the hood, so it's not like it's not fully contained, but it gives you positive pressure through your hood, so you don't breathe anything in, and it filters air as it comes through.
So theoretically, you get a leak and it blows out instead of in.
Right.
That must be an odd sensation.
Yeah, I didn't tell you guys. Well, certainly I haven't told anybody on the podcast.
I imagine that's similar to getting acclimated to a CPAP machine.
Well, okay. I remember.
I wouldn't know.
I remember Drew telling me the what is it? You had to do the the hazmat suit stress test.
Yep, I've done that.
Okay, and that's where they basically put the hazmat suit on you and see if you freak out.
Yeah, I mean it's just a respirator, so it's just a face thing. Yeah, and they sort of have you walk up a couple steps and back down and just kind of watch you for a few minutes. But so this job, we were it was like this deathbed confession of this dude who said that when he was in the army, he was ordered to bury Agent Orange in what was now like a residential area up near Toke. So this ended up being a funded cleanup job, an investigation, really, because we were just going on this guy's word. So we had to be prepared to excavate this area very carefully and locate any metal anomalies and test for the presence of Agent Orange. So while we're doing this, we had to be in these suits, and it was really hot because it was in the summer and up in the interior. And we had a crew of three or four people who would be in suits, and I was one of them. But we only had three suits, so we were sharing suits, which is not great when you know, it's hot and you get all sweaty.
Ooh, that smell.
Yeah, so that was already triggering some of my OCD problems.
Oh, it's like, well, you'll never be Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm at work, so yeah, kind of just have to go with it. So I was doing my shift, manning the excavation, and I was in the suit, and it freaked me out because this spider crawled across my face shield, and which is really jarring.
Because you don't want to hit it with the hammer.
Right. And it was even more jarring when I went to go wipe it off and realized it was on the inside. And so, like, all my instincts are to, like, shriek, like, this high-pitched shriek and go and just, like, tear it off like Cuba Gooding Jr. Just, like, rip my hood off and go running. You know, I'm in a crew of people who I work with, so I can't be known as that guy. So I had to force myself to be very calm and walk out of the excavation. And we had like a whole decon set up. So it's not like I could just go out and take off my suit. I had to go out and go through these different levels of decontamination before I could take my suit off. So I'm trying to go through all the procedures. And for that job, pretty much you just knocked off any solids that were stuck to you. But you did it in an area that was sort of cordoned off so that you wouldn't get any dust in the clean area. Anyway, so I had to go through all that. And then I had to finally get into a clean area where I could rip off my helmet. And in my head, I was, you know, I'm like, fuck that. I'm never going back. This, I quit. Never doing this again. But yeah, it was one of those like big hairy spiders that you see like up in the interior in the summer.
Like the orb spiders or?
Orb?
I don't know what orb spiders are.
They've got round orbish bodies and long legs.
Or more like wolf spiders, like fuzzy all over.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a good lesson. You should always check your helmet before you put it on.
I bet you checked every time after.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually, I'm grateful I did not embarrass myself, but it was probably the strongest test of my poker face that I've ever had.
Now, could you have gleeked on it? Oh, you wouldn't want to open
it. I don't want to make him mad. I didn't even want it to know I was there.
Like, could you have somehow headbutted it or something? Or there wasn't give in the helmet? Pretty rigid helmet.
Oh, I mean, at one point.
Because then
it
would have moved into his
mouth.
Right.
Yeah. It was like right in front of my eyeball. So, you know, like, you don't look at it, but you can't help but look at it. It's just, you know, really close to my face. And then while I'm walking away, it sort of scurried off somewhere, which made it worse.
So when you took off your helmet, did you find it?
I actually asked my colleague to do a spider check, a procedure I was familiar with from Cold Bay.
Oh, that's awesome.
No, I found it. I got it out.
You found it, but not the babies it left in your hair.
We don't need Sasquatch stories. You just have Drew's spider tails.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it was the whole thing. I mean, we had to duct tape our cuffs and our boots. And so it was not a quick process to get fully out of the suit.
Did you find Agent Orange?
No. No. We discovered a bunch of metal debris and some crushed drums, but when we tested it, there was no Agent Orange. So either his memory was failing him, or he didn't remember it was in the right place. But
or somebody lied about what it was.
He either buried stuff that wasn't Agent Orange, or he just didn't tell you where he buried it because he forgot.
Right. I mean, we found stuff, but, you know, It's hard to really wrap your head around the enormous military presence that was up here in World War II. But we find stuff everywhere.
Huh.
If you look for it, you will find it. But we did not find Agent Orange.
So, my outbreak story.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Jason.
That's okay. I'm used to it. I don't hold any ill will. This is my Schindler's List.
You took a date to Outbreak?
It was my first real boyfriend's real first date. It was our first, you know, getting to know each other. Let's go see a movie together. I'm like, oh, this looks like a fun movie. And then it was that awkward, quiet, really odd car ride home. Because, you know, the movie's kind of it's at the time, you know, that whole post-Cold War, just moved out, living with a roommate, being kind of by yourself all the time, and, you know, witnessing what could have been some kind of virulent apocalypse, and then meeting somebody new and all that in like a blender of the hormones and emotions of like, you know, a 22 year old or however old I was at the time. All of that together was just like this odd melange of emotional lasagna.
Well, and Jimbo killed his girlfriend by kissing her.
Yeah.
So, you know, kiss a stranger after this movie?
Yeah. This movie didn't do anything for my germophobia. So, so anyway, that was my story. So.
Okay. Well, it's, yeah. Well, Outbreak. Brother Jay, what's your verdict?
Well, I would say it's a good popcorn-y flick. I would give it a B minus. It, you know, it's a little dated. And some of the dialogue is, you know, kind of sloppy and slushy, but for the most part, I was entertained by it. It still held my interest. There was still some tension for me, and it moved along. It didn't really drag in spots. So,
Brother Drew, for the first time in this podcast, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. Was it worth it?
No, man. No. It's not worth it. This is not worth your time. You can easily find a better Dustin Hoffman movie. You can even find a better Cuba Gooding Jr. movie. You may not be able to find a better Patrick Dempsey movie, but you can certainly find a better action thriller very easily. This is not worth your time. It's dated. It's hammy. It's not even campy enough to be fun. This is a bad movie. It does not stand the test of time. I understand now why it's not available anywhere.
Well, it's available in my house because I enjoyed this movie. I'll watch it again tonight just to spite you.
I had to watch it from a DVR recording from a channel I didn't even know I had never heard of, called Pivot.
I enjoy their tables. It made you want to pivot away from the movie and watch something else.
It was weird because it had commercial breaks, but there was still swearing.
Well, I want to get
cable.
Get their money. I mean,
yeah.
So maybe you saw the edited version.
I was actually wondering about it.
Yeah.
I blame Pivot. I don't think they... Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was edited for time, and it certainly wasn't edited for content. Maybe they edited out all the good acting? I don't know.
Well, I give this movie a recommend. I think if you as long as you suspend your disbelief, it's a fun ride, talks about germs, it's got a charming Dustin Hoffman.
You thought he was charming?
I thought so.
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, okay, well. So next on our list is the 2011 movie Contagion, directed by Steven Soderbergh. I watched this movie when it came out on video the first time, and I think I was walking at that time too, and I tried to watch it while I was on a treadmill, and I got like 20 minutes into it, and I just turned it off because it was the most boring thing I had seen ever. I was like, this is not what I'm in the mood to watch. And I never picked it up again, never had any interest. Had heard that, you know, because Gwyneth Paltrow is a nice target of people who want to say bad things about people. And I'm willing to do that too. But when I watched it again for this viewing, I enjoyed this movie. This is a different, completely different genre of movie than Outbreak was. And it had a really good cast. And it was, you know, it was basically a straight up, like medical thriller procedural ensemble cast. And I found it pretty satisfying.
How is it a different genre?
It's not a fun shoot 'em up action movie the way Outbreak was. It was more of a "and the band played on" kind of serious look at epidemiology and what happens with like public panic.
I would like to point out at this point that both Outbreak and Contagion have the same star rating on IMDb at 6.6.
Yeah, and they made roughly the same amount of money, too. I mean, they were both successful. So, Brother Jay?
Yeah.
Had you seen this movie before?
I saw it in the movie theater.
Oh, on date night?
It was a date.
Excellent.
Which this makes me laugh.
So, what did you think watching it again for this?
Well, I hated this movie the first time I saw it. Hated it. And part of it was I had a visceral response to Gwyneth Paltrow. There's just something about her just instantly set me off, and having her be one of the first scenes in the movie, I was just, oh God, I was struggling in the theater to watch it and sit through it. And then at spoilers, there's the point in the autopsy where they like fillet open her head and throw the skin flap down.
Yes. That was
and I
great.
Actually, I laughed out loud in the theater full of people. It made me laugh. I just shrieked and started laughing because I thought it was hilarious and over the top. So anyway, I didn't have a good opinion. And on rewatch, watching it the other night, I liked it a little. I liked it. I didn't dislike it as much as I did. I actually kind of liked it a little bit from the apocalyptic standpoint and the social breakdown, the social stratus. Now that I'm in public service, it's kind of interesting for me to see kind of the breakdown of medical systems and social systems. And it's fascinating to me now because I kind of have in the back of my mind, I have to deal with that in a small way because I'm a first responder and I'm...
Yeah, you may be involved in a meeting that decides whether they're going to shut down the mall before Thanksgiving.
Well, we're also involved in, you know, in a small part, we may be involved in any measure of the strategic national stockpile because we're a public entity. So so I'm fascinated from that standpoint. So I liked some of this movie was fascinating for me from just a personal standpoint, but some of the acting was a little hard. Some of the subplots were really difficult for me to tie together. And I think that was another part is that there were so many different stories trying to go on that it didn't feel to me like it was a cohesive movie. There was too many little parts that they were trying to give you different stories, and I didn't want different stories. I wanted one story, if that makes sense. It didn't satisfy me as an entire entity.
Oh, it was definitely like an ensemble, like Shortcuts or like 2 Days in the Valley.
Yeah, and there was just parts of it that it just didn't make sense and didn't care about. I didn't get invested in a lot of the characters. You know, I got invested in Matt Damon a little bit, and I got invested in Jude Law a lot.
You didn't get invested in Jennifer Ely?
No, a little bit. And Lawrence Fishburne a little bit, but...
I liked Lawrence Fishburne in this movie.
He was good in this movie, we'll I'm not there. Saying. But then I kept seeing, you know, the guy he worked with from Galaxy Quest, so I just kept seeing... Yeah, well, I just kept seeing that in my head.
Dimitri Martin.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah,
because I'm not used to seeing him in a serious role.
Yeah, and they did nothing to change it. All they did was put him in a suit. They didn't change his hair or anything.
He could have had his little Casio keyboard.
Exactly.
But there was one thing that I wrote down because it bugged me. Why is it that Asian people are always the origin?
Population centers.
No. This is the last they made him out to be the villain in the last movie because he's on the boat with the monkey and I'm like, oh, they put him in the freezer.
No. Right? But he was an Asian boat, but it wasn't an Asian monkey.
No, but he was an Asian dude. So he was smuggling the monkey on the in Contagion it was the Asian cook who started it all. Spoilers, by the way.
Okay.
You should villainize the whiteys because we're terrible people. Come on.
So before we get into the whole plot and stuff, so Drew, what was your first reaction? Had you seen this before?
Yeah. I had a similar reaction to Jason. I didn't see it in the theater, but I saw it on video after it came out, and I did not like it. So after watching Outbreak, I was really excited, to throw this one on and get after it. But I had pretty much the opposite reaction. I watched it, and the circumstances I started watching it were a little challenging. I can tell you about that later. But Once I got into it and sort of wrapped my head around what a different kind of movie it was, I really dug it. I was surprised how much I enjoyed this movie because I did not have fond memories of it. So maybe that speaks to like what movie I was in the mood for this weekend and why this worked and why Outbreak didn't work for me. But I really dug the procedural aspect of it. I dug the quiet performances for most people. It really affected me, the stakes of this movie. You have main characters that contract the disease and die. And it amused me that Gwyneth Paltrow in real life has become what Jude Law was in the movie. So that was kind of funny.
We'll talk about her later too.
Yeah. But this is the role that I always identify when I see Jennifer Ely. This is the first movie I remember seeing her in and thinking that actress is really good. And I thought she was really good. She didn't have much screen time in this movie.
She used the most of it.
Yeah, she didn't give a showy performance, but she's really sort of the soul of the movie. Her and Lawrence Fishburne, who's really good, but he made me pine for his Agent Crawford mostly.
That's what I thought of. I thought, I don't know if I would have instantly trusted Lawrence Fishburne in this kind of role, and if I hadn't seen him in Hannibal.
Yeah, well, I wanted him to just lose it and yell at somebody, like an angry dad. But no, it was a really good, affecting movie. Matt Damon was really good in like a sort of a non-heroic role. You know, he was doing the best he could, but he didn't pull out any of his Jason Bourne moves.
You don't think he was heroic trying to forage and defend his household and his daughter?
No, I think he was really contained, like when they were out and about, he wasn't taking any chances. You know, when shit started to go sideways, he was like, all right, let's go.
Yeah, but
he kind of helped the woman who was getting trampled and was getting her MRE stolen, but yeah, like at the grocery store when looting started, he just got out of there, which felt right.
So can we go through the plot of this movie since it's, I thought it was interesting. I apparently wasn't smart enough when it started on day two. I actually thought, oh crap, did I make did I have like a weird copy of this or something? So I went back. I'm like, no, it starts at day two. That's great. So I thought that was kind of fun that eventually you get to see day one, but not until you get further into it. Cause this is like a mystery as well as being like a drama, but I guess it wasn't so much of a thriller. Like it wasn't based on action and like a ticking time bomb, although it was kind of a ticking time bomb. But I mean, millions of people were going to die in this movie. This wasn't about this wasn't about averting a catastrophe like Outbreak. This was trying to contain a catastrophic event. And I think they were commended for the amount of science that went into this. I mean, it wasn't perfect. The science was not exact. It wasn't like a documentary. But
there was some creative license for sure.
Yeah, but they tried to make it as realistic as possible, and the idea was that even when I guess Soderbergh after is it the informant, whatever movie that was, he wanted to do a medical thriller with the writer that he was working on that movie with. And they kind of came upon this sort of idea. And what struck them was that this was not a matter of if this event occurred, but when it's going to occur. You know, that's what the hot zone, actually more likely that's what Demon in the Freezer tells us, is that there will be these pandemics. And it's only a matter of time. And the fact that we travel as much as we do freely is not, you know, and it's even like things like SARS and stuff, it doesn't prevent people from spreading diseases. I mean, we can't even keep a lady who is directly in the proximity of the Ebola virus. We can't even keep her inside the house in real life, you know? And so she mm-hmm. comes off as being kind of right. She's a Dustin Hoffman character in real life. But the consequences of her ignoring the public health warning could have been really bad. So, you know, that's what, like, Elliot Gould in this movie. Elliot Gould ran a level 3 laboratory, and this was deemed to be a level 4 only organism, whatever. But he didn't destroy his samples like he was supposed to. He went along and tested it, which was great for the plot of the movie. But in real life, I mean, the whole point was that he could have killed millions of people based on hubris.
This movie had a great cast. I was surprised how many people are in this movie.
And it
did have some great writing. I mean, Elliot Gould has that quote when he's talking to Jude Law, where he says, "You know, blogging is not writing; it's graffiti with punctuation."
Yeah,
I mean, that to me. So that made this movie to me better than Outbreak in retrospect, having rewatched both of them. So out of the two movies, I think this movie is better. Also, because it was made more recently, I suspect it stands up a little bit better.
I don't think it was better. I think it was deeper. A different kind of movie. This is not a popcorn movie.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it's better.
Yeah, I would have to say that it's a better movie. It felt less gimmicky and less comic booky.
It was more true to life. And the fact that there was a little bit more, I like the Jude Law character because did you get a sense that at any time he was actually right? No.
I thought he was a crackpot from the beginning. And then just completely elevated more crackpot level at his amazing bubble suit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, and at that point it becomes pretty clear that he's scamming people. But, you know, in the beginning, you don't know I didn't know the difference between a conspiracy theory nut who manages to stumble on something real. Now that's always the concern.
No, if he was going to be the righteous voice of the savior, they wouldn't have given him that fucked up tooth.
The snaggle tooth with the Madonna gap.
So what do we think about Marion Cotillard, who is the WHO doctor in charge or something?
She was fine, but I think she had the most disposable storyline.
Yeah, I think so too. So here's the basic plot, and we're gonna ruin it because
we ruin everything.
Yeah. But this movie starts off in day 2, where we see Gwyneth.
Well, in fairness, Outbreak ruined itself.
that Gwyneth Paltrow is getting a call at an airport bar from a guy she just had sex with, who, as it turns out, is not her husband, and she's looking a little rough and kind of coffee. And then we see a couple of different characters: the guy in Hong Kong, the guy in the model in London. The businessman on the plane that all end up getting sick and dying. And we see the guy get hit by the truck in Hong Kong. It's kind of dramatic.
Jarring.
Yeah. And then, so Beth Imhoff is Gwyneth Paltrow. So she comes home to her husband, Mitch, played by Matt Damon, and her son, Clark, who turns out is her son, not their son, but oh well. And she's a little sick. But whatever. So then we meet Dr. Ellis Cheever, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who works for the CDC in Atlanta, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he's a nice enough guy, nice to the janitor. And at this point, Mitch gets a call from the school saying their son is sick. So he goes and picks up the son. And then we meet Jude Law, who is at the in offices of a newspaper, trying to sell this story about this, an outbreak of some kind of disease or whatever on a bus in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and he's saying this is all about mercury in the fish, and it's all a big scam, and the paper is basically blowing him off and telling him you need to go away, don't come back, because he's a nut.
Or is he?
Yeah. Then we go home to Beth's house. By now, this is called day four in the title cards, and Beth gets worse and has some seizure acting, which yeah.
I took a strange Schadenfreude satisfaction out of that. I shouldn't have.
Poor Gwyneth. She's so easy to hate.
I thought she did a pretty good job in this movie.
She was fine. You know, she did what she was supposed to do.
Died.
So as her husband goes with her to the hospital and she dies in the hospital. And I thought it was actually a really nice scene where the doctor tells Matt Damon that she's dead and he doesn't get it.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But realistic.
Oh yeah, it seems like it would be very realistic.
I like how there was the doctor and like the administrator, and when he's not getting it, the administrator just bails.
Yeah.
She's like pulls the ripcord.
Yeah, like
I'm out.
Peace out.
At this, I'm out.
And eventually the doctor does too. He's like, we've got some good grief counselors. And he just leaves.
Yeah. Leaves the guy by himself, which is very sad. And then the guy gets a phone call from the friend of the family, whatever, that's babysitting the son who's sick, and he rushes home to find a dead child. Just, we already know when there's a dead child in a movie, it's not a comedy.
So if the younger kid isn't his, does that mean the older kid isn't his either? The
older kid is his.
The older kid is not hers.
Right.
She's got another mother.
Yeah, she's got a mom and a stepdad in Minnesota or wherever.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so Gwyneth was her stepmom.
Yes.
And then yes.
He was the kid's stepdad.
Yes.
Yes. Right. Blended family.
Not for long.
Because the daughter had that speech about, about how, you know, her home was here with him and that, you know, he's not her dad.
Yeah. That mom has Larry. She doesn't need me. You need me.
Yeah.
All your family died.
Yeah, Larry's that swinger upstairs.
Oh, come and knock on his door. So we go to Switzerland to talk to meet Marianne Cotillard, who works for the World Health Organization.
Cougeau.
Yeah, exactly. And they hear about this brief. She gets a briefing on this mystery virus, and so all these pandemic plans start to come to the WHO and to the CDC. And then we go back to Hong Kong. And we have more people dying. Then in the synopsis here that I got from IMDb, it says that in Chicago, Ben's lover, John Neal, is being carried out to a stretcher and his wife looks on wondering what's wrong. I didn't get that was the boyfriend or ex whatever.
Wait, what?
Yeah, the guy that she was sleeping with in Chicago. Apparently mm-hmm. we get to see him being wheeled out and his wife being sad because he was sick too. I didn't realize that was him. That was just some rando. And then we get to see the autopsy on Beth, which I thought that was fun. You get to peel her head back and put the skin over her face. It's pretty good.
I still laughed.
Well, what was great about that scene is, there's that gruesome opening up of her head, which the doctors are fine with. And then they look at whatever's inside there and they start to freak out.
Oh, it's great. It's like, you want me to take a sample? No, I want you to stand away from the table. Huh. Should I tell somebody about this? They're going to call somebody? You should call everybody. Yeah. It's great. It's a great piece of acting as far as like without mm-hmm. seeing.
I got distracted by Marianne Cotillard because I kept seeing her versus Nicole Sullivan for Mad TV. If you put like a dark haired wig on Nicole Sullivan, I see the same.
Oh, that's hilarious. From like King of Queens and Mad TV?
Yeah, I kept expecting that voice to come out, and it wasn't. So that distracted me a little bit.
Well, so every time we went to Hong Kong, you were probably thinking of Miss Swan.
Exactly.
What did the sick person look like? Oh, I tell you everything. He looked like a man. So a teenage daughter comes back from college or whatever. I guess she's not from college. She's in high school, right?
Yeah.
So she's coming back from some sort of her mom's house, maybe?
I think so.
Yeah, I think because it's probably holiday break or something, because it was winter.
Yeah, so she comes home to be with her father, who's obviously had a traumatic time. And so we have these couple of things going on. We've got the story of, like, the CDC and the WHO trying to suss out what the cause of this thing is and trying to figure out how to deal with it. You've got the human drama of Matt Damon. And then you've got the conspiracy theories of Jude Law.
You mentioned the WHO investigation subplot.
Yeah.
In Asia. Yeah.
We get another strand there when the WHO ends up going, Marion Cotillard ends up going to Asia and gets kidnapped by the guy whose village has been decimated.
In a pretty ballsy extortion racket.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty great. Actually, I like, even though that was a subplot that could have been avoided, I think it was nice that it was there.
Did it add anything to the story though?
Not really.
I mean, it didn't add anything to the movie for me. Yeah. I mean, you could have left that out, and it would have made the movie like 20 minutes shorter. But it didn't. It seemed like there was
it would have made it 5 minutes shorter.
It seems like something was missing. There's some deleted scene or there's something that, and I didn't have a special feature, so I don't know, but there's something missing out of the story that I think would have tied it together. But just as it was, it just didn't ring.
Yeah. Cause they set up the WHO and then they send her to China and then she disappears for like 45 minutes in the movie.
Yeah.
So there's that. I could see where there is a missing scene. So if Elliot Gould that comes in, and this is where we meet Jennifer Ely's character and Dimitri Martin's character, who are their doctors in the biolab level 4. Which, by the way, we don't need exposition because we've already seen Outbreak, and they did the great exposition in the beginning of that movie.
So the beginning of Outbreak and the end of Contagion.
Yeah, good thing I watched Outbreak.
Yeah.
Really paid off.
So and then we go to, from one set of scientists to another. We go right to Bryan Cranston, who's taking a break from making meth and is the Homeland Security Director or something. Or a Homeland Security Officer.
He's pretty high up.
Yeah. I love the fact that they talk about whether or not somebody's like weaponizing this bug or avian flu. And Lawrence Fishburne's character is like, oh, we don't need to weaponize it. That's the birds have already done that.
Yeah.
So that actually is a nice little point to make, is that this is not a monster movie, you know? Like in Outbreak could have been kind of a monster movie.
Well, they tried to make a villain out of an entity. In this, there was no direct villain. There was no villainy afoot.
Yeah, it turns out Jude Law was basically the villain.
Yeah.
And panic.
Mother Nature was giving us all the middle finger.
Yeah. The tagline of this movie is, nothing spreads like fear. The contagion isn't about the actual virus. The contagion is the fear and panic and that kind of thing. Oh, except virus kills millions of people in this movie. So there is that, but yeah. Drew, when you're telling your story about the pop-off suits and stuff, I immediately thought that you were going to like basically uncover the alien craft from the Thing movie. And then I realized, no, that you actually survived that thing. So it's probably not, that probably didn't happen to you.
As far as I know, I survived and I'm not the alien.
Yeah. So then, because we're not done with adding fun characters, we end up with meeting Kate Winslet.
She was my favorite.
For real?
Well, between her and Jennifer Ely. Yeah.
You bought her as a doctor.
Yeah, I did. I liked her.
More than you liked Dustin Hoffman.
Totally. She's very matter of fact. She's the one that explained Arnott, right?
Yeah.
I was down with her. She told that dude to stop touching his face.
Yep.
Without even looking at him. That's like such a mom thing to do.
Yes. Yeah. And she was no nonsense, but she was also practical.
Yeah. I liked her quite a bit.
Yeah. I liked the fact that, she set up the big quarantine area and then ended up unfortunately being in it herself, and Lawrence Fishburne tries to save her, but politics get in the way, which is another problem, which I thought was a nice little way to jam that in there without being too heavy-handed and preachy.
Yeah, and she unceremoniously dies 2 days after they ran out of body bags.
Yes. Yep. And that's, you know, you get to see body bags being thrown into mass graves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they keep telling you, like, the populations of all these cities as you go to them, which I thought was interesting. I thought that was a good choice that they continued. Yeah, so this thing ratchets up, and they finally figure out, Sussman, Elliot Gould, figures out how they can grow this, because they have to, they explain in a pretty clever way, or a concise way, they explain that they have to grow enough of this to, in order to study it and figure out how to cure it or how to prevent it. But so far they haven't been able to grow it because it kills everything that they put it in. That's a problem. You know, that's the nice thing again about Ebola and those kind of things is that unlike smallpox, where you can be infected and get weeks away or at least days away, you know, with something like Ebola, you don't really have very much time before you get symptomatic and then just die. So it burns itself out in the jungle before it ever gets to a population center, theoretically.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
Unless you're Patrick Dempsey on a plane.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, you know. Or whether, you know, if you're Gwyneth Paltrow that comes back, as it turns out, spoiler, she is pretty much patient zero. And, yeah.
So. Yeah, well, the WHO lady figured that out pretty early on. They just didn't know how she contracted it in the first place.
Yeah. Which, as it turns out, is important, but not crucial. Because, you know, they have to deal with, you know, on one hand, you have to deal with the problem at hand, which is preventing the spread of this thing and dealing with the public order problems. Because, you know, as soon as you get something like this, I mean, I can totally see from the public order side of it, shit breaks down. So when there's looting in stores and stuff. That's bad. That's its own problem. It's one of those things where if all of a sudden the government isn't able to doesn't give you that happy sense of security anymore, then you're less likely to go in for your mandatory vaccinations. Like the 12 million people that were convinced that Jude Law was right.
And I did like the fact that the main preventative measure that they came up with was social distancing, which was, you know, stay in your homes, stay away from everybody else, which feels true to life, was a problem for the teenage daughter.
Oh, yeah.
She was not on board with this concept of social distancing.
No. And, you know, social distancing for a couple days is easy enough.
Right.
But as soon as you need to go shopping, that's a problem, especially when there's no place to shop anymore. So that's when, you know, Mitch starts looting the neighbor's house, because what are you going to do? So much like the earthquake that will come in Alaska or, you know, the big old ice storms that knock out the power grid that'll come on the West Coast. I guess earthquakes on the West Coast, too. You know, shit's going to happen and there's plenty of plans, but
I was surprised that with all the social breakdown that every service seemed to be still kind of adequate. There was power. There was, you know, there seemed to be medical, there's still medical response, ambulances pulling dead bodies out, even though there was trash everywhere. It was kind of, I'm not sure that how realistic that part would be. If you have a pandemic to that level where people are staying home, not sure that everything would be just as stable as it was. You wouldn't have workers to move food around. You wouldn't have, I mean, you'd have a problem.
Yeah, no, shit would start to break down. I mean, I think there would be a certain amount of, like, for instance, public safety or public health workers or even private health workers that would still come to work because they had that job to do.
I would have to go to work.
Yeah, but I mean,
they would come and get me.
Yeah, if nothing else, you would want to, that would be one way you could actually help. But if you worked at a grocery store, fuck them. Like, I'm not going to go and you know, like, unpack pallets at Kohl's when the shit goes down.
Well, the likelihood is, depending on, I mean, our market economy is built on transport. So after 2 days, especially when transportation will break down, in 2 or 3 days, there isn't anything.
Oh, yeah. Well,
especially
in
places like Alaska.
Yeah, and we learned from 9/11 what happens when you halt all plane flights for a couple days, and people start to be very concerned about getting the mail, and we're making sure the banks work correctly, because you can only go to the ATM for so long.
Yeah. Have direct deposit, because getting that paycheck flown from wherever the home office is sucks if no planes.
Yeah, well, even your direct deposit stuff might be an issue. So, yeah, lots of little things. But, you know, you can't encompass that. And that would be interesting to look at. I don't know why I say interesting is maybe the wrong word. That would be one way you could look at it if you had, say, the Contagion series on FXX.
Yeah, this would be a fascinating series.
Yeah, it almost needed to be because it's such a different type of movie. Like Eric said, it's really jarring. Like, if you don't know what you're getting into, it's hard to figure out what you're watching at first.
Well, and it keeps changing stories. So that was my problem with it, is that I kept going in the storyline, and then it would switch. And then it would switch back, and I'd have to put myself back into that mode and try to remember what was going on, where were we? And so that was distracting to me.
Oh, yeah. No, you definitely have to pay attention in this movie. And because they keep, you know, there's no, I mean, not like Take Shelter or Blue Ruin, for instance. The tension in this movie is never, for me at least, got so great that I needed some sort of big release. But there is no comedy in this movie.
Well, and the pace doesn't really let up either.
Yeah, the pace is not fast.
No, but it's steady.
Yeah. I think it's well paced, but it's just a slower paced movie because it's not an action movie.
Mm-hmm. It's very deliberate.
Yeah, deliberate. Mm-hmm. There you go. You think after 200 podcasts where we talk about deliberate pacing being a good thing, I didn't remember that word. But
not halfway.
Yeah. But then you get to see a lot of angles, and you're right. The WHO lady getting kidnapped in China was not necessary. I mean, it didn't really add anything. It gave you other than humanizing her, but we didn't. I mean, she was pretty much unnecessary. But I like the fact that you get. You know, I mean, Mitch keeps having problems just getting along. And do we ever determine what Mitch does for a living? It doesn't actually matter, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's not particularly blue collar, but he's not certainly a scientist of any kind. And he doesn't he's not a superhero. He doesn't have any extra things. He basically he cares about himself and his daughter. Maybe not in that order. And
he doesn't have anything else to be doing in the middle of the apocalypse.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So he's just got day to day stuff to deal with. Like, for instance, finding a funeral home that will take his wife and stepchild. Because no one's going to take the plague victims, right? And for good reason.
But his mother-in-law that's trying to gloss over the fact that she knows her daughter is having an affair.
Yeah.
She made mistakes, Mitch, but she loved you.
Well, that's the thing is that, everybody's got their own baggage. And I thought it was handled really well in scenes that weren't too long. Let's see. So we got that little subplot about the kidnapping and then he tries to get out of town in Minnesota and he's turned back, which is, again, because states have started to, the social order is kind of breaking down and everybody's kind of trying to circle the wagons.
Keep containment.
Yeah, it's kind of a siege movie, sort of. And yet, it's funny because the threat is of a disease, but the threat is also other people, too.
Well, other people are more dangerous than the disease.
Which is why the tagline of the movie.
Buzzing.
Yeah. And so here's we have where Jude Law says that he's got this miracle cure, or he knows of the miracle cure for the disease and claims to be sick and takes the miracle cure, which I think is pretty much we know that that's that he's pulling a scam.
Snake oil.
Yeah. And he's making money. And later you see those posters of him where half of them say profit with a PH and another say profit with an F. It's pretty great. Like, who has time to do street art during the apocalypse? Love it.
Street artists.
Yeah, they come to work, right? I remember an officer telling me that you will never find a more dedicated employee than a drug dealer on the street. Man, they are working 24/7, 365.
Well, it's good they have such a strong work ethic.
Yeah, well, you got to keep the money coming in. Yeah, and then we have Lawrence Fishburne again. He's not a superhero either. He has issues, one of which is loose lips.
Yeah, he's going to get fired and maybe brought up on charges at the end of the movie,
right? Yeah, because he calls his soon-to-be wife, I guess, his fiance.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Saying, you can't tell anybody, but get the fuck out of town. And, of course, she tells somebody, which, you know.
Stupid.
That's what happens. Well, that's what happens, you know? Oh, he's talking get Sanjay Gupta. That was kind of fun. The cameo.
And so I had a particularly troublesome time watching the first 45 minutes of this movie because so for the past couple months, I haven't really been drinking. Sorry, that came out weird. I haven't been drinking, but I had a particularly tough week at work. I was feeling a little stressed out this weekend, so and we weren't going camping, so I treated myself to some bourbon. And I don't know what got into me, but I decided to break out like the heavy stuff, the high proof stuff. Normally, I enjoy the lighter, smoother stuff, but I just went for it. So I broke out the Booker's, and gave myself about a 3 second pour over some ice. And it was I don't drink it very much, even when I am drinking, because it's so strong. But for some reason, I was just in the right mood, and I was like, "Oh, this tastes pretty good." And it went back pretty quickly. And so I made the rookie mistake of, "Oh man, that was good. I think I'm gonna have another." So another like triple. And then after that, I was like, "Oh shit, I need to go to bed." So I went and put myself to bed and put on Contagion. So I was trying to navigate the weird structure of this movie, like while my head was swimming. And I had a similar reaction to Eric. I was like, wait, did I fall asleep? Did I miss the beginning? I don't understand what's going on. So, I watched about the first 45 minutes before I had to tap out. Really, all right, I'm gonna have to finish this after I've had some sleep.
I think the confusion in the story was on purpose. I think they did that to mimic the confusion you'd have in society.
Oh, it was clever at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, it made more sense when I could think straight. For sure.
Yeah.
For Cynthia.
Exactly.
I could have used some that night.
Pretty much, it just kind of from there, it's a procedural where, you know, they have a lottery for when they have the drugs, and there's only so many of them. And so that was interesting. And then we have, we finally get the final flashback where we find out how this whole thing started, which was a bat that infected a pig. That infected Gwyneth Paltrow.
And it was Gwyneth's company that was
yes,
knocking down the trees that were destroying the bat's habitat, which made it go find a refuge in the pig farm, right?
Yes. Which that's kind of preachy. That was a little preachy, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, all in all, well, okay. Any other notes before we go on to your verdict?
I thought Matt Damon going house to house looking for supplies and food and protecting his daughter was... that was pretty heroic. I thought that was amazing. Because he put himself in peril and danger in unknown situations in an unknown time. You know, that could have easily have turned bad for him. So I thought that was interesting. And then when you see her... I've just forgotten him, but when she self-administers the vaccine dose to herself,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Oh, Salk style, I was like, oh, no, don't do it, don't do it.
But did you think she was going to die?
I did think she was going to die.
Yeah, which is the brilliance of this movie is that, you know, we've already had main characters die. Mm-hmm. In fact, we've had mostly main characters die.
Yeah, and then you have the crazy vaccine paranoia where people aren't sure if it's real or not, and then was it going to damage them? And then the lottery, the vaccine lottery was kind of interesting, I suppose. But then at the end of the movie where U2 makes Matt Damon cry, so.
Yeah.
And then the fact that, in the closing, I wrote, damn it is bacon that will kill us all.
Well, what was Matt Damon doing there after? Was he just taking pictures of the prom?
He
was going to grab the camera to go take pictures.
Yeah. So, very cute.
Back when there were cameras.
Yeah. Although they did pretty well with the cell phone texting between the kids.
Yeah. And they mentioned Twitter, right?
Yeah, I think so. Before the president was using Twitter.
That's right. Well, that was before the president ever had a smartphone, too.
Yeah, true.
He still doesn't have a smartphone.
Well, hold on. Hold on. Yeah, the president had a BlackBerry.
2011. Yeah.
He probably would have had the first iPhone, but only because they made it finally encrypted. What was the
he didn't have an iPhone.
Right. And
yeah, they made him get a BlackBerry.
Yeah. But he didn't want to give up the iPhone.
Yeah, because the BlackBerry was hardened and the iPhone was not. It was for security encryption.
Exactly. Now we don't care about any of that. Imagine those quaint times. So many things.
Well, it turns out the iPhone was actually just as secure. It just didn't have the reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, the FBI had to try and get Apple to agree to let them hack that guy's phone.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay, so Brother Jay, what's your verdict on Contagion?
I'd give it a B. I'd say it's half a grade better than Outbreak.
Brother Drew?
That's fighting words. Contagion is great. It's this weird kind of movie where you need to know what you're getting in for, because it is a slower paced movie with very little action, almost entirely a procedural. So you need to be in the right headspace for it. But I think it's a really good movie. It's interesting. It's got interesting structure. It's got a ton of people, and it's got the Soderbergh thing where he's not afraid to linger on people and let a scene slowly play out to increase the tension, which works well for this type of story. So if you're in the right mood for it, I think this movie is very much worth your time.
Well, okay, and Steven Soderbergh directed the Ocean's 11 movies.
Like maybe ones we've talked about on our podcast.
Well, Side Effects is on the calendar. I want to watch that with us. What ones have we talked about on the podcast already?
Out of Sight.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. Aaron Brockovich. Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I bet you that doesn't hold up.
Aaron Brockovich is a great movie.
Yeah. Traffic, which was a better miniseries than it was a movie, but it was an okay movie.
Have either of you seen The Limey?
Nope.
No, huh?
That's a good movie.
And then he directed 20 episodes of The Nick.
All of them, I think.
Yeah, okay, well.
Have either of you seen the trailer for the next movie he has coming out?
No, huh?
Which is?
Logan Lucky?
No.
No.
Oh, it looks amazing. You should check out the trailer. I don't want to ruin it for you by giving anything away.
I'll go look when we're done.
Wow, he does a documentary on Spalding Gray called "And Everything Is Going Fine," and I know you guys were never a big fan of Spalding Gray, but I love Spalding Gray.
I like Spalding Gray better than Stephen Jesse Bernstein.
Well, yeah.
I cannot imagine a Soderbergh directed documentary of Spalding Gray. That's like deliberate pacing squared.
Can't wait. That goes on the top of the list. Also, we know how it ends. Not well. So, yeah. So, anything else on Contagion or Outbreak? Drew's got an Ebola story.
Are you still planning on this being one episode?
Yeah.
I think he has to because he mentioned it in the beginning.
Yeah, and also because, it turns out that we had 20 minutes of Outbreak talk.
I'll make it really short. There is a podcast episode of a podcast called Weekly Infusion. It's a Dr. Drew podcast. But whether or not you like Dr. Drew or not, this one is interesting because it's an interview with a guy named Dr. James Fallon, who did... So Jason's nodding his head. He's an interesting guy.
Jimmy Fallon. Yeah, Jimmy Fallon.
Nope, different one. He did a bunch of studies of brain scans to try and figure out if you could predict like psychopathic behavior based on an MRI of your brain. And he found interesting results. But the part that has to deal with Ebola is one of his personal stories. So it's Weekly Infusion, episode 30.
So you're not going to give away the story. You'll just have us check it out.
Yeah.
Excellent. That's a good recommendation.
I probably couldn't do it justice. But his story is really fascinating, and the conclusions that he came to, about, brain activity, nature versus nurture. It's really interesting.
Sweet. So, anything else in housekeeping?
I have a car story.
Please tell.
The dealership I bought my car from is not in Portland. It's in Beaverton, which is an adjacent city, kind of a sleeper community. It would be kind of like akin to Eagle River.
Like suburban community?
Yeah. I mean, it's on the highway. It's close enough to drive. People live there and commute into Portland. But it's big enough that it's self-contained on its own. So you could live in Beaverton, and it's bigger than Eagle River. But, I mean, you could live in Beaverton and never leave it. Work, live, and eat, all that. But because it's not in Portland, obviously, then taxes are cheaper for purposes, I'm sure, of land, property, business, etc. So buying a car out there is cheaper than buying a car in Portland. So that's where we bought my Explorer from, because it was cheaper by a couple, $4,000 or $5,000 than the Portland dealer, which is significant. But the drawback is that if I want to have service, I have to go to them. If I go to the local Ford service, I will get service, but it's a little more complicated. It's all done by Ford, but it's a little more complicated since I didn't buy the car from them. If I really needed some warranty work, they would do it, but it's a hassle. So I just go out to Beaverton, which is, it's a drive. It's, you know, it's 30 to 45 minutes on a good day. And if there's traffic, it's an hour or so. But I've now had my second oil change. So I've had the car for a year and a half. I just have 9,600 miles on it, I think. So oil changes every 5,000 miles. But so I took it in to have oil changed and tires rotated. And I noticed a couple months ago in the driver's door when it was open, in the door limiter, which is the little bar that is pinned to the chassis of the frame and to the door to keep the door from pulling out far, too far. It's a kind of a hinged pin joint.
Yep.
That it was rusting at the pin. It was bright, coppery red. And so I asked Derek, I'm like, this doesn't look normal to me, and it doesn't look like any of the other three doors. It looks to me like this is a bad part, so I want it replaced. And so I go to the dealer on Friday for the oil change. I mentioned that, you know, this needs to be looked at, and then if it's warranty work, it will be warranty work. If it needs work, then we'll have to schedule time to have it fixed. And so the dealer's like, well, I could fix it. But the part's going to be like, it's going to take some time to get the part, but I could probably rip it off a car in the lot and swap that out when we get the part in. So if you wanted to wait, we could probably do it today. So I was like, I suppose I can wait. I didn't really have anything to do that was pressing on Friday. So, they do the oil change, rotate the tires, hand wash the car. change the part out. And I'm like, I'm all happy. So I'm like, okay, I don't have to come back. Cause that's what he said. He was, this way you don't have to come back. You're all done. You're in and you're out, and you know, you spent an extra hour, but it's all fixed. So I get home and it's fixed, except it's not fixed, because to get at the pin, they have to take the door apart and take the door assembly apart and then take everything in the assembly apart. So they have to take the door panel off, and they have to take like the stereo speakers out, and then they have to take the wiring harness out, and they have to get at the mechanical guts, and they have to put all that back together. So Sunday, I try to pick Jesse up from a party he's at, and I pull in front of the house where he's with his family, and he comes over, and I push the unlock button on my driver's door, and nothing happens. So I'm like, well, that's weird. So I push it again, nothing happens. So I thought, well, that's bizarre. And then I realized none of the other buttons on the driver's door work.
Nice.
And I haven't used them because I don't usually use the unlock and lock, because if you open the door handle, it unlocks.
Imagine finding this out at the drive-thru.
Well, the windows still worked, but none of the other buttons work. So the windows are different on a different panel. So the windows were fine, but my mirrors don't work. The memory seats don't work. I mean, this is like all first world problems, but the memory seats don't work and the unlock lock don't work. I mean, I can manually lock and unlock from the driver's door, and the unlock button works on the passenger side just fine. So,
they just didn't plug something back in.
They didn't, except I'm going to have to go back out there to have them fix it. And I'm leaving town.
Oh, that's true.
So I called today and I talked to the service dealer and I said, I need an appointment and it needs to be Saturday. And so they said, well, because Derek's going to have to take it in. And he said, well, we're pretty busy on Saturday. And I said, you're going to fix this. Like, you broke it. You're going to fix it Saturday. So I pulled a little, you know, a little bit of that Father dad Anderson attitude. Yeah. I channeled our father. And, the long story short is like, in the meantime, I have a car that works. It's just inconvenient. And of course Derek's kind of cranky about it, cause he has to take the car in to get it fixed. But so it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Car that works, but there's something wrong with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, that's every car. Someday I'll have a car that's not like that. Did I tell you the story about the trunk? Journey in the trunk?
No.
Okay, a quick little thing. It had nothing to do with car problems. But Journey and I, we went, stopped at like Walmart or something. We were at Walmart, but just for something quick. And on the way in, we saw these people that were loading their groceries into their sedan, and the hood was open. It was a small little sedan, so it was a little tiny, not the hood, the trunk. So it had a little tiny trunk, and Journey is like, that's a small storage compartment they have. Like, how cute is that? That little tiny storage compartment. Like, what are you talking about? She goes, that. I'm like, the trunk? She goes, yeah. I'm like, huh. You've never had a car that had a trunk. You never had parents that had a car that had a trunk. We've always had SUVs. So I thought that was, I just filed that away and we go do shopping or whatever. And as we're leaving, as something to do just as distraction, because you find things to distract your kids with, we're stuck at the light at 88th and Old Seward to go north to go to Dowling eventually. But so we get stuck between like 88th and Diamond on the Old Seward, as you do. And so we're sitting in traffic and I'm like, so Journey, let's look and find sedan. So you can see the difference between a sedan and an SUV and a pickup or whatever. It took like 3 minutes to find a sedan. There were no sedans. It was all, I mean, the closest you could find is like a hatchback, like a Subaru, but nothing had a trunk. It was amazing. It felt so Alaskan. And later on, you know, we drove by a couple of car dealerships and you could see even there, none of the sedans are out by the end of the road. It's all like trucks and SUVs out, you know, on big display.
Yeah, nobody wants a sedan. They want like a crossover because they want to have room.
Yeah. Yeah. And very, very few cars don't have hatchbacks now.
I have a trunk.
That extra space makes a big difference. Just having that little square top where you have taller stuff you can put in.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to this little shallow trunk.
Oh, well, that's why she thought it was so adorable, that little storage compartment. As if it was like an alternate glove box or something. But we did see your mom and Journey and I the other day saw a 1969 Z28 for sale.
Wow.
Black. Mm. Guess how much they wanted for it?
You were forbidden to tell Jesse.
Guess how much they wanted for it?
$8,000.
See, that to me, that sounds like a regular, like a great number. Because it was nice. I mean, somebody painted it and it had like some sort of like turbo carburetor, blah, blah, blah. So it was probably kind of souped up and a muscle car to begin with, but $8,000 would have been great. That's slightly lower than what he wanted for it.
$12,000?
Keep going.
27,000.
Keep going.
No.
$30,000.
No, you're high.
Yeah, that's what
he's
high. That's what I'm like. There's
it's
no
It's never going to happen.
Like, I don't know what he thinks, but.
You can't insure it. You can't get parts for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and it has no airbags, and it doesn't. You have to put additives in the fuel probably to have it. You know, it's crazy. There's no way.
The seatbelts are probably made out of dental floss.
Yeah, you don't actually have to have seatbelts. Probably
Ralph Nader just shakes his finger when you drive by.
No, that's a no, honey. I really am trying to sell it. Price.
Oh my God. That's got to be what it is. Yeah. Though you hit the nail on the head. Because there's no way. There is absolutely... Or that's the humble brag. That's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was crazy. I'm not a car person. But, I mean, it caught my eye because, it's, you know, it's different. It's kind of cool. It's not $30,000 cool.
He's not... If he were in Vegas and he was hitting up, like, some kind of Asian business convention where a bunch of rich Asian investors had just money to burn, maybe. Maybe. But that's a bad movie plot right there.
The Guy Fieri fan club.
Oh, God.
By the way, I have nothing against Guy Fieri, but that's just, you know, his fan club would drive around and...
Guy Fiero?
Well, it's Guy Fieri.
No, it's not. He's a dork. I can't stand him.
Ah, see?
Speaking of fans of his, make sure you do yourself a favor before you go to bed and watch the Logan Lucky trailer.
Okay. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.